I'm sitting in for Susan LeBay today as we do a special tribute to Black History Month with a focus on the hidden figures of New Mexico, those African-American women who have excelled in science, technology, engineering, and math. But they won't be a hidden figure after today. We're in the land of the believer. Now, let's get busy with some real wonderful information and meeting some amazing women in the state of New Mexico who are doing incredible things. They may be hidden figures today, but they won't be hidden figures tomorrow. So most of you remember that there was a movie that was released on December 25th, 2016, and the title of that movie was called Hidden Figures, and it talked about a trio of African-American women who worked at NASA and who helped advance the space program for the United States. So with that in mind, I want to introduce to you some of the amazing guests that we have in our studio, some of the hidden figures of New Mexico. So first, we have Dr. Melanie Moses. Dr. Moses is here, and we're going to have her tell a little bit about herself. We have Dr. Carissa Colbert, and We have Dr. Betty Harris, and we have our youngest and newest member of the STEM projects going around, but she is no newcomer to the work that she's doing. Her name is Ramona Diaz. So let's say first, good afternoon to Dr. Melanie Moses. Dr. Moses, welcome to Women's Focus.
Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me to be part of this wonderful event. It's really an honor to be among these brilliant women, African-American women scientists. And so I'm very pleased to be here.
So where are you working now, Dr. Moses?
I am a faculty member, an associate professor of computer science and biology here at the University of New Mexico.
And what does that entail? What do you do with all of that amazing work that you just described?
Well, our primary research efforts are around building computer models of complex biological systems. And so what that means is we model systems such as the immune system of the human body. We're interested in understanding how cells that are part of the immune system, how they move around in your body, how they identify infections or viruses that you might have, and then how they attack those foreign invaders and protect you, keep you healthy.
And so does your work expand beyond the university?
Absolutely. So in addition to modeling immune systems, we've done some work modeling ant colonies. We, in fact, use the same computer models to model how ants move around in a colony and how they cooperate to gather food for the colony. Those models are based on the same basic principles as the immune system models. But the ant models, we take and we turn those algorithms, that computer code that describes how ants forage for food, we've turned them into algorithms for swarm robotics. And swarm robotics, and then we've established, actually with NASA, a swarm robotics programming competition called the NASA Swarmathon Challenge. So this challenge involves now students from 42 minority-serving institutions from around the country. And we're working toward 1,000 students who will have participated in the last 2 years in this challenge. Their job is to build robots. We send them robot kits. They build these robots, write computer code to control the robots, and the robots compete against other swarms of robots to try to collect as many resources as possible that we scatter in the landscape.
So that's quite interesting. You use ants to also help determine how you can improve the health of humans. I wondered if the ants know that.
I think the ants are entirely unaware of what we're doing when we go out and study them.
So let's talk a little bit about you, Dr. Moses. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Maryland, in a small town outside of Annapolis, Maryland, and a place near the Chesapeake Bay. So being out here in the desert is different for me. And I came to New Mexico back in the year 2000, where when I started a PhD program here in biology.
So did you attend a historically black university or college in preparation for all the work that you're doing now?
I did not. My undergraduate degree was from Stanford University. I studied in a program called Symbolic Systems, which was an interdisciplinary program, a program that suggested to really understand the modern scientific challenges, you need training in a variety of different disciplines, including, in my case, computer science, even linguistics and philosophy.
And you talked about these robotics that you built, rather. How do you get students involved in those robotics and building those robotics, and how do they use them?
So it's not hard at all to get students involved in robotics. Students love to play with robots. In this particular challenge, where we have students from a variety of these historically black colleges, tribal colleges, Hispanic serving institutions. These are students who are really hungry for challenges in science and engineering. Often their schools don't have enough resources to support these students. And so what we've designed is this competition, which really has a simple goal of program a group of robots to go around and collect as much stuff as they can. But the number of skills and the kinds of skills that the students have to learn to engage in this challenge and be successful, it's incredible how much they're able to learn. So they learn new programming languages, they learn new software engineering tools, they learn teamwork, and students then write this code, often quite complex code, that interacts with things like the GPS on the hardware of the computer that controls the robot. And all of those activities are ways that they're building up their skills while they're engaging with their teammates in what turns out to be a really exciting activity.
So are the students who participate in building these robots, are they only college students, or is that open and available to other students also?
So the students who build the robots are all college students. We have now 85 of these robots that we've created kits and sent them around the country. And those are all college students who build the robots and program the robots to interact in the real world. Ultimately, what they do is they search for things on the parking lot in Kennedy Space Center. So that's where we actually hold the competition. That's supposed to be a replica of the Mars surface. It's not very accurate, but it's still very exciting to be able to participate in a competition at Kennedy Space Center.
So are high school students able to participate in that program?
Yes. So we have just this year launched a high school version of the competition. And this is a version that is entirely in simulation. So the students don't actually program robots. They program simulations of robots. And the students who do this, some of them are right here in New Mexico. We have students in a program called Computer Science for All who are learning to program in their high school classrooms. And we also have students around the country in other high schools who are mentored by the college students to design their own swarm of robots entirely in simulation. And so they have their own competition. They can win prizes, and we'll announce those prizes at this physical competition at Kennedy Space Center.
So can you just tell us briefly, how do students get involved in this program? Is there a way that they apply? Do they call you personally? What is that process?
So the best way to get involved is through a program called Computer Science for All that was started here in New Mexico about 5 years ago. And this is actually the Computer Science for All program is now a national initiative. President Obama launched a national initiative that borrowed the name Computer Science for All and is attempting to create high school courses around the country based on the idea that everybody should have access to computer science education. So the view that I take is that computer science literacy now is the new literacy. It is as important as mathematics and writing. These skills of being able to write your own code, be creators of technology, these are the skills that you need for success in the modern world. And so the Computer Science for All course is an entry point for students, particularly around the state in New Mexico. So we've had 1,000 students who have gone through the program so far. We are very anxious to get new schools and new students on board. And so the best way for students to get involved is to advocate at their schools. We train teachers, often teachers who don't have any experience even in math or science, to become computer science teachers in their high schools. And then those teachers will teach their students computer science. And we're finding that students who are getting this training early in high school are then able to go on to majors in computer science, math, other STEM or science and engineering disciplines. And it gives them a real advantage in both their college careers and subsequent very lucrative careers in software engineering and computer science.
So thank you, Dr. Moses. If you're just tuning in, this is Pamela Herndon in for Susan Lube on Women's Focus, where we are highlighting African-American women who are the hidden figures of New Mexico, those women who are excelling in science, technology, engineering, and math. We just heard from Dr. Melanie Moses, a professor here at the University of New Mexico. Let's say hello to our next guest. She's none other than Dr. Carissa Colbreth. Dr. Carissa Colbreth, welcome to Women's Focus.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here today.
So tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing so that we can learn about how you are advancing in those four areas.
Yeah, so I am an assistant professor at the University of New Mexico in the School of Medicine. I'm in the Department of Pathology, and my role there is as a clinical microbiologist. And what that basically means is that I'm responsible for the laboratory where diagnosis of various infections occurs. So everything from the diagnosis of strep throat to HIV, everything in between, monitoring these conditions and understanding how they're affecting our population is what we do in our lab.
So that sounds incredibly exciting. Did I say that did I hear that you say you also use robotics?
I do. So one of the things that we recently implemented in our laboratory was a robotic system that actually handles the specimen. So instead of a person having to handle the specimen and process the specimen, we just recently in the past year implemented a robotic system that processes the specimen and moves the specimen even along a conveyor belt, puts it into a incubation space, and it's incubated, and then there's an imaging system, and it's all done by robotics. So there's an imaging system where a picture is taken of that culture, and everything is then processed digitally rather than manually holding all of those cultures and samples.
So is there any correlation between the robots that you use and those that Dr. Moses puts together?
I would say probably the best correlation is that I'm glad that there's people like Dr. Moses who can figure out the robotics and the engineering behind it. That's definitely not my forte. So I'm glad that there's engineers and computer scientists that can do the programming and we can do the microbiology.
So now, how did you get interested in this field?
You know, I am like one of those weird STEM kids. Like, I've always loved science. I've always loved chemistry. Like, that's what I asked for Christmas when I was a kid, like chemistry sets and microscopes and crazy stuff like that. I remember one Christmas, I got a science kit that had a frog for dissection. And my mom was always very supportive of everything. But the one thing that she would not allow was the dissection of the frog in the house. So we had to leave to do the frog dissection. But, you know, I grew up here in Albuquerque. I went to some of the inner city schools here. I went to Longfellow Elementary. I went to Albuquerque High School. And so it was, you know, great education in our public schools here in New Mexico that really prepared me and fueled me with various programs to get me to where I am today.
And what about your college? Where did you go to college?
So I went to Fisk University, which is in Nashville, Tennessee. It's a historically Black college. And it was amazing preparation for my science background. They actually have a huge, it's a small university, but really great funding around the science programs. It's very closely affiliated with Meharry Medical College, which is right across the street from Fisk. And so my education there was just bar none. I mean, it was truly, truly amazing. I worked with amazing professors who really invested in me and helped to propel me.
So now that's your undergraduate work. What about your graduate work?
So for my graduate education, I went from a historically Black college to a predominantly white institution. I went to Vanderbilt University. And so there I did a PhD in microbiology and immunology. It was a wonderful program. I really, really enjoyed the program. It was very rigorous, but great support. And I was glad to be there. And then from there, I went to the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill to do a fellowship in medical and public like health microbiology. And then as part of that fellowship, I was able to actually spend 2 months in Malawi, which is in Africa, to help with diagnosis and development of new technologies for the diagnosis of HIV and tuberculosis in the setting that's appropriate for the resources that they have.
Wow, that is absolutely incredible. Now, how do you get students engaged in the work that you do, or how do they know about your work?
Yeah, you know, I think kids, they kind of get fascinated by germs and gross things. And so it's easy for me to get kids interested in the things that I do because I can talk about how gross it is, because definitely there are gross parts of what I do. But one of the things that I've done to try to help to propel students and get them interested and excited and thinking about their future is I recently wrote a children's book. It's called Daddy's Little Girl, but the book is about a little girl that doesn't know what she wants to be when she grows up. And her father starts to encourage her and empower her and remind her that she can be many different things. And so I do have one of the things that was important to me in the book was to make sure that I had some non-traditional careers for girls. So there's no princesses in the book, but I have, you know, a scientist, I have an architect, I have a pilot, I have a firefighter. And so I definitely had to have a STEM focus because that's what I do, but I also have a judge and different things that that girls can be. And so that's really important for me that there's that empowerment level.
So now let's talk a little bit about that book. I understand that you received a special recognition as a result of that book. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the book was recently nominated for an NAACP Image Award. So I was able to go out to Hollywood and spend some time with some of the celebrities and really some of my heroes in the entertainment industry. And so it was a great opportunity to have the book recognized at that level.
So this is are you now giving out signed copies of those books to girls when you see them to encourage them more to go into some of these STEM fields?
Yes, I've probably given more books away than I've sold, actually. But it's so important to me that the story is out. I think it's relevant. I think it's really a time where we can get girls involved and engaged in STEM. It opens so many doors. I really believe even just the foundation of STEM is mathematics. And once you know math and you can do math, the doors to the careers and the opportunities just fly open. And I think it also is very empowering. You know, math is one of those subjects that you really have to conquer. And once somebody can conquer math, they feel like they can do anything. And so I really think that we have to get that out and get that message out that it's important and make sure that people see men and women that look like them who have conquered these subjects and then taken it to the next level.
Now, what made you decide to stay in New Mexico? I mean, why didn't you go off to NASA in Houston or some other place like that? What made you stay in the hometown where you grew up?
Well, I think I'm still trying to figure that one out. I think, you know, I honestly had no intention. I'm coming back to New Mexico, clearly spent quite a time away, all on I-40, though. And so maybe I was too close to I-40. And then I just came back because I ran out of highway and hit the ocean. But now that I'm back, one thing is the job that I have is amazing. And I absolutely love the opportunity to work here in New Mexico. There's a lot of work to be done. And I do believe now that I'm back here, it's important that we aren't hidden any longer. So many people who are born here, take their resources and move because there's a lot of places that are probably more exciting and more engaging that you could live. But what happens is that then there's nobody here to support the people that are here, to support the students, and they don't see anybody that looks like them because we've taken our resources and we've relocated them. And so since I am here, it is very important to me that I show the students who are here what it looks like to be successful.
And so is there an opportunity for an internship in working with you or working with the work that you do? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, internships for me personally have been, I think, the thing that has propelled me from one step of my career to the next step. So I usually, I've been having maybe one or two students who work with me over the summer on a research project. Often they come through programs through UNM. And so that's been a great opportunity for me to work with women of color, African-American women, Hispanic, Native American men and women on various research projects. And I encourage people to apply to internships at whatever level they are. The summer internships are probably the most powerful tool to get you admitted to the university you want to attend. Even if it's a very competitive university, it's not what you know, it's who you know. So when you have somebody who's writing a letter of recommendation from you and they've been part of that university, you can get into any college, any university. So I really, really recommend that students apply to internships, whether it's with me and through programs at UNM or Stanford, Harvard, Oxford, right? You do anything, get into these internship programs. That's what will open up the next door.
If you're just tuning in, this is Pamela Herndon in for Susan Lube on Women's Focus, where we are doing a tribute to Black History Month, focusing on hidden figures in New Mexico, those African-American women in our state who are excelling in science, technology, engineering, and math. So we heard earlier from Dr. Melanie Moses. You also heard from Dr. Carissa Culbreth. We'll come back and talk to them a little bit more in the show. But right now, I'd like to introduce you to the youngest member of the STEM team that's here in New Mexico. Her name is Ramona Diaz. Ramona, welcome to Women's Focus.
Good afternoon, Pamela. Thank you for having me.
It's so great to see you engaged and involved in STEM programs. So tell us about your work, Ramona.
So currently I work for the Air Force Nuclear Weapons Center as an electrical engineer, studying different aircraft and weapons effects.
And what does that mean?
Well, while the national labs own and maintain nuclear weapons, the U.S. Air Force, from our point of view, we sustain them for operational use. So in my particular job, we want to ensure that the pilots and their air crew can successfully perform a nuclear mission if they need to, survive it, and then return back safely. And this is extremely important to me because pilots have such a challenging job. And when they go off to do a mission, they trust that their aircraft and the associated weapon systems, that they're capable and fully functional to complete the mission. And so it's our responsibility to ensure that the aircraft does fly the way it's supposed to and that the weapons do work the way they're supposed to.
So Ramona, tell us how you got interested in this field of work.
I attended Norfolk State University in Norfolk, Virginia. That's the area that I grew up in. And they offered a full scholarship for STEM majors. And I applied for it, and I was lucky enough to receive a full scholarship in electronics engineering. And upon graduation, I moved to Atlanta, Georgia, and went to Georgia Tech to receive a master's degree, also in electronics engineering, electrical and computer engineering, to be more specific. And for that program, the Air Force offered to pay for the second half of my master's degree in return of working for them in New Mexico at the Air Force Nuclear Weapons Center. So after I graduated in 2012, I came to New Mexico in the fall of 2012, and I've been working here since.
So now, as you were growing up, were you always thinking about a STEM field to go into when you were going to graduate from high school?
Honestly, I wasn't. Both of my parents had enlisted into the Navy, and I thought that was what I was going to do as well. And my parents guided me in the direction of college, and they wanted to see me just develop a stronger education. And because of the full scholarship that Norfolk State offered, they were very pleased that they didn't have to pay for my school. And in return, I got the degree in electrical engineering, and I'm actually thankful for it now. Looking back, I've been able to do a lot with it, and I've had some amazing opportunities.
Now, in the field that you're working in at Kirkland Air Force Base now, are there other African-American women who are in this field too?
Within my office, there's about 25 of us in my office, and I am the only African-American female engineer in my office.
So what about that is absolutely amazing. So hopefully after today, we'll see Kirkland out there looking for more African-American women to follow in your footsteps. So are there opportunities for young African-American girls or girls in general to become engaged in the work that you're doing at the Air Force Base?
There are always opportunities. Again, I believe internships definitely give you a foot in the door. I started out with an internship with the Navy, and that kind of pointed me in the direction of the things that I wanted to study. And I was able to use that experience in my essays for the scholarship applications, and then the Air Force accepted it. So there's always opportunities for internships, and I think there that's a great way to get your foot into the door. But then we also do mentoring as well. Recently, we participated in a STEM event, and we just want to encourage people that it's cool to be smart, and you get to do a lot of things. And I think sometimes the opportunities and the wide range of professions that they can go into is just not recognized.
So you've been here in New Mexico for about, I think it is 4 years now. So what's making you stay?
I love my job. I love the fact that while I'm not the one flying planes and delivering weapons and protecting the country, I can still serve my country by making sure that the people who do these jobs have all of the things that they need and are fully capable of performing the mission.
You know, one of the big points about the Hidden Figures movie was all of the math that those women were engaged in. So tell us a little bit about some of the math courses that you took on your way to the position that you now hold.
When I was in high school, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And that's okay not to know. But what I did know is that I was good in math and science. And I was able to utilize that again and learn more in undergrad through my calculus and differential equations, and then apply that to a variety of courses, not just my math courses, but my science courses and my engineering courses, incorporated them as well. And that's actually one of the takeaways that I noticed in the Hidden Figures movie with Miss Dorothy Vaughn. As she prepared for the introduction of machine computers, she taught herself the programming language Fortran, and then she taught her staff. And one of the things that is really helpful for me in my career is reading and staying on top of the things that you're responsible for and teaching yourself and making sure you know how to do your job and how it fits in the big picture of things. And so math is truly a foundation to opening doors for other opportunities.
And that is incredible. And I think that it's important that young students are able to see you and how you have excelled in the field that you're in now. So if you had any one advice that you wanted to give to young girls who are now graduating from high school and looking for their next step in terms of their education, what would that advice sound like?
I would tell them to work hard in school, whether it's high school, whether it's college, because the harder you work, then you're able to maintain good grades and have a great reputation with the people who are willing to help you make it to the next step. And find out what you're interested in and just excel at that, because these opportunities will open as you become smarter and as you become more informed about the things that you're interested in. And I'd also tell them to be open to opportunities. Honestly, I didn't imagine myself living in New Mexico. I grew up on the East Coast, and I thought that was where I was going to stay my entire life. Obviously, I didn't, because I'm here in New Mexico. But because I was open to the opportunities and I was able to move outside of my comfort zone, I've been able to excel here and in my job. And I'm so thankful for the people who saw that in me when I didn't see it in myself.
Do you have the opportunity to talk to girls in a community setting, in churches, in other types of community organizations? Do they get to hear from you in that regard at all?
Sometimes they do. I am a member of Delta Sigma Theta sorority, and we have mentoring events occasionally, a couple times a year. And we get to talk to younger females about our experiences and just encouraging them that they're capable of doing anything that they put their mind to. As long as they work hard at it, it will happen.
Thank you. We were talking to Ramona Diaz. If you're just tuning in, this is Pamela Herndon with Women's Focus, and we are we are focusing on the hidden figures in New Mexico, those African-American women who have excelled in the areas of science, technology, engineering, and math. So now we're going to turn our attention to the woman who is the trailblazer in these areas, and the woman who actually we think laid the pathway for all of the women that you heard from this today so far. So she is none other than the amazing, the incredible, the wonderful Dr. Betty Harris. Dr. Harris, welcome to Women's Focus.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me to participate in this event, because I was certainly looking forward to it after reading the book.
Well, you are absolutely, you know, you may not be as hidden around the world as you it appears to be that you are in New Mexico, but we are certainly happy to make sure that all of New Mexico knows about you after today. Tell us a little bit about your work, Dr. Harris. When you were working at, let's start with Los Alamos. Let's talk about your work there and the work that you were doing when you were there.
Okay. Well, before I came to Los Alamos, I was a teacher. And one day while I was at LSU, Louisiana State University, I was reading the bulletin board. And on that bulletin board, they had some job advertisements for people to work at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Well, it was Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory then. But I had no idea what they were and what they were doing.
And so what prompted your curiosity to continue to move forward?
Basically, I'm a very curious person, and if there's an opportunity to do something different and it's safe to the extent that I can actually do that, then I'll try it.
So you were teaching school first.
Yes.
And then were there many African American students in your class?
Oh my goodness. Yes. There were. Well, when I started teaching, they had those auditoriums they would put the students in, and you may have 75 students where you walk down the aisle and passed out the sheet at the end of the table, and then everybody signed and passed it back. So that were, yeah, I was teaching at Southern University in New Orleans.
Wow. And so do you think as a result of your teaching that many students, particularly women, went into the field of science or technology, engineering, or math?
Yes, because at that time, basically, that was probably the way that you would be directed from my high school, because I had excellent high school teachers, and most of them were very good in science and math.
So you went from high school teaching, and then from there you saw this advertisement?
Yeah, that's how I got into the National Laboratory, reading the bulletin board.
And so you applied for a position at this National Laboratory.
Yes.
Is that what happened next? Now, that's pretty incredible. You are this wonderful science teacher, but you're leaving these students behind that you've been teaching to go now to this National Laboratory. So how was your transition from high school to this National Laboratory?
Well, from high school, as I said, I went to Southern University.
Yeah.
But in high school, I had excellent teachers, so I had the foundation. However, I should tell you that I grew up in the country in Northeast Louisiana, and that was kind of cotton country. And so we didn't go to school very much. We went to school after the crops were planted and came up, and then after they were gathered, which is usually late November. And so we didn't go to school, but they didn't have truant officers then, so we could stay out of school and work, which is what we did. I remember once in junior high school, that's when they had those freedom riders and things and freedom trains. And we were given like a fair day or something where we could go and see the exhibits. And so we did. We went to see the exhibits. And I'm forgetting the lady's name, but I remember her. she started a college, and she was a black lady, and she was a short black lady. And she walked up to the podium, and she stood on this bench, and she said, "And this beautiful little black lady that stands in front of you," and oh, we just smiled because we weren't really supposed to think that highly of ourselves in that time, but that was a wonderful time for me. And I went from that high school on into Southern, like I told you, but it was by way of a very long trip because I went to Atlanta University from Southern University, which is basically the scenario of the trip in which women took. I went to Atlanta University for my master's, and I told someone, say, you know, when we were so poor that financially, not in other things, but financially, that we got ready to graduate, and I didn't have the money for the cap and gown.
And so what did you do?
Well, somebody behind me told me, said, just look in the box, put one on, and come on. So I did. And so one of my brothers told me, you need someone from Atlanta University, and you owe them money for that cap and gown. But, yes, and so I went to Atlanta University. And from there, I went to University of Wisconsin, Marquette, and I did my coursework there. And then when I left the University of Wisconsin, I came back and revisited the lab's offer and those things. But when I got back to revisit the lab's offer, it was really better than when I left because they had something called a STEP program.
So what is a STEP program?
Well, you have all of the qualifications, but you haven't been trained in the basic things they want you to do, specific things you want them to do at the laboratory. So they allowed me to get into the lab on the STEP program, and then they started teaching me the things they wanted me to know and accomplish as far as nuclear weapons systems were concerned. And so I had some wonderful, wonderful people all along the way who were guiding me as to should I do this or should I not do that. I would always consult with my more knowledgeable colleagues on what do you think about this? And if they said go for it, I would go for it. And keep in mind that I had three children at the same time.
So have any of your children gone into the science fields or followed in your footsteps at your career at Los Alamos?
Yes, my son Jeffrey was an electric engineer. He's deceased, but he was an electric engineer, and he went to the University of California, he went to Southern University of Southern California. Anyway, I had asked him to go on and take a full scholarship with the Air Force Academy because we were living in Colorado at that time. And he refused to do it. So he went and spent the rest of his political career flying F-15s for the Navy or something. I think he could have stayed in the program we put him in, but he didn't want to do that. So, and then my youngest son also went a military track because he did fast attack submarines for the Navy until he retired, and so he's down in El Paso somewhere. But no, they and
you
my
had a daughter.
Oh yeah, I got a daughter. My daughter graduated from Los Alamos High School, and that is an excellent high school. And she went to the Naval Academy, and so she stayed in the Navy for 3 years. And they require something that you have to. You have to give them so many years if you of service after you stay there for so long. And she didn't want to do that, so she left. And my understanding is she's somewhere down near the WHIP site or the uranium site doing research for the state of New Mexico. So, they all had scientific backgrounds and could do that.
That is absolutely incredible. Now, let's go back to Los Alamos just for a few minutes. We can't leave that because it's right here in New Mexico. You talked about this STEP program. Do you know if it still exists?
Pardon?
Does the STEP program still exist at Los Alamos?
In some form. It might not be the same form as it was when I was there, but it is there in some form. So there is opportunity for them to study and then do scientific work also. Because after getting on that STEP program, they made sure that I finished my PhD, and it was really a fascinating, beautiful thing. Before, every summer, Harris and I, my ex-husband, we would take the kids and we would find summer programs, because at Southern University, they would provide programs for staff members that had been there for a number of years, or staff members but they didn't for younger people. They expected us to find summer work somewhere else. And so we did. We would take the kids and go to Oklahoma City. We went so many different places, but it was also a learning experience because we were connected to scientific programs, and we found out what many of the other colleges and things were doing, and so we could afford to travel and then come back to our job here at Los Alamos or wherever we were. I have to tell you, that lady whose name I couldn't remember was Mary McLeod Bethune. She did my junior high graduation ceremony, the one I told you was standing on the box.
Wow.
So I told one of my classes that, and they said, "Oh, Dr. Harris, you certainly are old." I say, "Yes, I know."
That is pretty amazing. You got to meet Mary McLeod Bethune.
Yes.
That is an incredible part of history, that it is wonderful that you were able to share that with us on the air today.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of, let's just talk a little bit about your pathway in the area of your career. So what kind of barriers did you face, or did you find that there were challenges facing you because you were an African-American woman?
Of course, but it didn't. It wasn't something I dwelled on. When I started my teaching career, I worked in a small town called Itabena, Mississippi, and it's right down the road from Greenwood, Mississippi, or Greenville, Mississippi. Greenwood, Mississippi is the place that all of the civil rights disturbances were in. But the state of Mississippi did not grant that college funds for the year. And so all of us were there, and we were not paid. And so one of my college professors from Atlanta University told me, why don't you try New Orleans? And so that's when I left Itabena, Mississippi, and tried something different as far as a career was concerned.
Wow. And so when you ultimately ended up at Los Alamos National Laboratories, did you also have the opportunity to visit other laboratories and work at those areas in addition to your work in New Mexico?
Well, basically, we went where we were sent. And I remember one year we went to Brazil. And there was a Los Alamos project there that we were taking data off of these systems. And I don't know whether that language was Portuguese or whatever, but the gentleman who was head of my group, he understood. And so we took data off of systems and came back, and I remember we went through Paraguay, and we went through some looked like jungle-like places to me, but they probably weren't. They knew where they were taking us, and so, but I did. I went there, and I did what they told us to do, and I came back.
Well, we're glad that you came back. We're certainly glad that you are back here and back in New Mexico. But we haven't talked a lot about some of the inventions that you were responsible for and about your patent that I know about. But I want all of New Mexico to know about the patent that you created and a little bit more about your work to the extent that you can talk about it.
Okay, I'll tell you about the patent first.
Okay.
If you've ever gone through an airport and you are pulled out of line, they will take you in and do some swipe tests. And they are swiping for explosives and many of the things associated with that. And so I invented that spot test is what it was, where they can swipe your hands or your feet, and they can tell you whether you have explosive powder on your person or on your clothes. And
so now when people go through the airport, they can thank you for that. And so can you tell us about some of the other things that you helped to work on, for example, when you were at Los Alamos, and if we can do that without divulging any
they aren't classified.
Okay,
anyway,
that's good.
My job was to synthesize high explosives for the nuclear weapons system, and one of the successes, and so there are about 8 high explosives, and we synthesized those. One of the successes and the science behind the explosive is that the oxygen itself was built into the explosive. You know, if you have a firecracker and you take something and wrap some nitrate in it, let's say potassium nitrate, throw in a little sulfur and wrap it in some paper and light it, that's called just a homemade match or something. Well, with the high explosives, the oxygen is in the explosive. It's part of the chemistry of the explosive, and they call them plastic bonded explosive for a reason, PBXs. So my job was to synthesize PBXs at the laboratory for the nuclear weapons program.
Wow. So you sort of led the way for the job that Ramona Diaz is doing now at the Nuclear Weapons Center. So we appreciate that and the trailblazing work that you've done. So, but you've also done work and you continue to do work to help girls within the community in the fields of science or chemistry. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was president of New Mexico Federation of Business and Professional Women for a number of years. And we concentrated mostly on getting girls into science and math and getting them comfortable with it, and also looking at what we could do to encourage women to be better at taking care of self and family. And for many years, you know, the woman stayed home and she took care of the family. But then when we started getting into the job market, we wanted to also have the opportunity to contribute to the economy of the whole thing. But I remember once when our New Mexico legislation was meeting in Santa Fe, and they had halfway houses for men, but they didn't have any for women. So that was our thrust of what we were going to go to the legislature and discuss with them for that year. And so we did. And eventually they did have halfway houses or houses for women to better themselves or get into the field of helping themselves and to move forward.
So now I understand that you were somehow involved with the Girl Scouts and about a badge that was created that you helped to create as a part of the Gold Award that Girl Scouts could earn. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the Boy Scouts, and my sons were Boy Scouts, had many opportunities to explore and go into the wilderness and camp and all of that, but the girls did not. And so I thought that we needed a Girl Scout badge. And so we came up with, and we called it a chemistry Girl Scout badge. We came up with a series of experiments that they could do to qualify for the Girl Scout badge. And so we used one of the local facilities, set up the experiments, and let them went from station to station. And I had many, many people helping me, I tell you, because, well, Los Alamos has a lot of PhDs and scientists and everything else, but they came over and they actually helped with those merit badges. And so I didn't do it all by myself. I came up with the idea, but many of the parents were the ones that made it a success.
So I do know that it's wonderful. We have two Girl Scout groups in the state of New Mexico. And so I'm going to look to see how many of them are earning that chemistry badge. That will be good to know. But, you know, one important issue that we haven't touched upon, you indicated that you were married, you had three children, and then you have this amazing career in chemistry and you're working at Los Alamos National Laboratories. How did you balance your career and your work in those areas? I mean, I think that Ramona would be interested in learning about that as she continues to develop her career, and others who are listening.
Well, I had a wonderful family, and my mother, when my children were very small, my mother would take them, for an example, when I was at Itapena, Mississippi, and wasn't being paid, one of my brothers came and got the children and took them to my mother, and my mother, who had taught school for a number of years, she took care of them for me. And so I don't mind reciprocating that kind of dedication to family. And so, yes. And then the other thing was, I know you've heard of Nevada Test Site.
Yes, we have.
Okay. Well, at Nevada Test Site, I bet my youngest son had gone to circus more times than you can name, because when I had to spend a week at Nevada Test Site, you know, the men could cap out and what have you, but they would let the women go into town, and we could stay at the hotel, and they'd pick us up in the morning and take us to work. Well, my youngest son was the recipient of a lot of that. His name is Aloyd Jr., too.
Oh, so they found other ways to stay busy while you were staying busy.
Right.
I see. So one of the other things that often comes up, particularly in the state of New Mexico, and maybe you can touch upon this a little, is we always wonder about whether or not women are being paid fairly. So you were engaged in a field that sounds like it was predominantly men or male oriented. So how did you feel about what you were being paid? And did you think that you were receiving fair pay for the work that you were doing?
Well, actually, no. We knew that we were not. And if I were to check the data today, I would almost bet that women are not being paid fairly. And so the problem at Los Alamos National Laboratory came one of adequate pay for women, not adequate pay, that's the wrong word, but not being paid for what we were doing. And so that ended up to be a class action suit, and EEOC and several other people were involved in that. But they would allow us to make $999,001, but you could not make what the men made. And so there was a class action suit, and some people said that some of the men said that they were wasting money on the women, but I didn't think so. So I took a leave of absence, change of station, that's what you call this thing. And I went to DOE, Department of Energy, U.S. Department of Energy in Germantown, Maryland. And I became a certified classification, declassification specialist. And that meant that we could read and act on the U.S. Department of Energy's data, and we could declassify it, or we could leave it classified, or we could send it somewhere else. So I did that for 11 years. And then in 2011, I came home and retired.
Wow. All I can say is I'm glad you came home and we're able to hear your story today. If you're just tuning in, this is Pamela Herndon in for on Women's Focus, in for Susan Lube, where we are talking to hidden figures in New Mexico, those African-American women who have excelled in the areas of science, technology, engineering, and math. They may have been hidden figures before today, but they will never be a hidden figure again. We'll be back with you in just a moment with more of our hidden figures in New Mexico. So we're talking to the, if you're just tuning in, let me tell you who our panel of women are in the studio today. We have with us Dr. Melanie Moses from the University of New Mexico. We have also Dr. Carissa Culbreth, and Dr. Culbreth is with X-Ray Associates.
Tricor Labs. And University of New Mexico.
And University of New Mexico. And then we have... We have Miss Ramona Diaz, and so she is with the Nuclear Weapons Department at Kirkland Air Force Base. And then we have the woman who was the trailblazer who led the way for all of these women. It is none other than Dr. Betty Harris. She's live and in person with us right here in the studio. So let's go back for just a moment and talk to to Dr. Melanie Moses about how she got interested in science and the fields that she's at the University of New Mexico. So, Melanie, tell us a little bit about how you got into this field.
Well, my interests really started when I was a little girl. My grandmother, who was a teacher, this is a theme I think has emerged a number of different times here, that it's our families and our teachers who really nurtured our interests in these STEM fields. My grandmother used to call me on the telephone and play math games with me for hours on end. She would give me algebra problems and logic problems and little geometry puzzles. And that taught me that I was good at math and I loved math. I enjoyed the challenge. My parents certainly nurtured that in me, encouraged me to always take, you know, the hardest math and science classes I could in high school, to take an internship at Morgan State, which is an HBCU in Baltimore, and at the Naval Academy near where I lived. And so all of these sort of laid a foundation of interest and building skill in math and computer science. When I went to college, my mother gave me a book called Gödel, Escher, Bach. And this was a book about the mathematical foundations of emergent phenomena. So, for example, the ant colonies that I talked about, how your mind and thoughts emerge from the interactions of your neurons in your brain. And these were even related to things like how a beautiful piece of music emerges from the interactions of notes. And so all of these things have common mathematical foundations, and when you get to explore with these, it opens up whole new worlds of and whole new ways of understanding the world. I'll also say a particularly concrete example of what sparked my interest is that I lived in the rainforest in Costa Rica for a few months. And so I was in the rainforest among monkeys and spiders and all sorts of interesting insects. And I became there fascinated with ants, who are these tiny little creatures. The forest floor is just alive with ants going around collecting leaves. It looks like rivers of leaves moving through the rainforest. And I really wanted to understand the dynamics that made these systems work. I actually came to New Mexico because the Santa Fe Institute, right up the road, is really the premier institute for research in complex systems in the world. And so there are just fascinating scientists from Los Alamos and also from, you know, university to all around the world that study these complex systems in economics and physics and mathematics and computer science and biology. And so, you know, working with those colleagues, my colleagues here at UNM in a variety of different departments, is really, you know, it's it drew me here, and it's the reason that I've one of the reasons that I've stayed in the state.
So, you know, we heard from Dr. Harris telling us a little bit about some of the barriers that she faced as an African-American woman in a field that where there were not many women and certainly not many African-Americans. Can you tell us about some of the barriers that you might have faced as your career has developed?
So computer science is an interesting field. It opens so many opportunities when you're a computer scientist. You can work in absolutely any field when you're a computer scientist. But the population of computer scientists is about 85% white and male. So there are very few women. There are very few African Americans in the field. And certainly that presents barriers just in not seeing yourself reflected in the field where you are, having few mentors whose steps you can follow in. I'll say that one of the other reasons that I love being in New Mexico is that we have the chance here to really change the face of STEM and computer science. So I mentioned the Computer Science for All program earlier, and I'll just put in a little plug that any high school student out there or high school teacher who's interested should Google New Mexico Computer Science for All, and you'll find lots of information about how you can get involved in this field. And so for me, some of what makes it easier to persist as a computer scientist is being able to work with these young students, the high school students in Computer Science for All, wonderful women and students of color who are so talented and enthusiastic when they get exposed to this new field. They're incredible. The same with the students from the Swarmathon, right? Just incredibly talented students who, when they realize that they can be creative, they can solve problems in their own communities by developing these STEM skills in computer science and math. They really inspire, you know, the rest of us to continue on in this field and to recognize just how many doors are opened up by having these skills. So in some ways, I think, you know, the way to overcome these barriers that we face is just to bring more people on board, right? And that starts to remove the barriers for everyone.
Wow. You all are telling some amazing stories. Let me just go to Dr. Culbert. Can you tell us, in terms of your career and moving forward, and we're looking at this because we're looking at it through the eyes of what happened in Hidden Figures. What about you? Tell us about some of the barriers that you may have faced as your career has been developing.
Yeah, you know, I think the story is so similar across many fields that we're not always well represented in our careers and in our fields. So we have to do a lot of our own advocacy to get us to the next level. And I think it's particularly important that we highlight the hidden figures, that we uncover the hidden figures. Because knowing that there was somebody who went before you and blazed that trail for you really has a huge impact. For me, I have a particular instance that I remember when I was in my fellowship program, just having a particularly bad week, bad month, probably bad few months, just feeling overwhelmed, feeling like I didn't know if I could do it, feeling inadequate, having imposter syndrome, where you feel like, you know, somebody's going to finally realize that you're not that smart and not that intelligent, and they'll kick you out. And, you know, just having all of those voices in my head telling me that I couldn't do it. And I remember this particular instance was I was working on some cultures, some bacterial cultures, and I was using this media, this agar media that you use to determine if antibiotics will work on bacteria, if you can treat the bacteria with this particular type of antibiotic. And the media is called Mueller-Hinton media. And so I was using it, and I was in the laboratory by myself. It was a late evening, and I was crying, like boo-hoo crying, because just feeling so overwhelmed. And I'm using this Mueller-Hinton media. I have it all stacked up, like it's as high as I can kind of see. And I have all this work to do, and I have all these voices in my head, like, you can't do it, you can't make it. And just having a really, really bad day. And so fortunately, I got through that moment. And then when I was doing some research about women and African Americans in clinical microbiology, I found out that the Hinton part of Mueller-Hinton was actually an African-American woman that developed this media. And so realizing that at that, which I would feel that was one of my lowest times in my fellowship and in my educational career, a time that I felt completely inadequate, and knowing that there was an African-American woman kind of there symbolically with me, and I was using her work to propel my work forward, it was so powerful to me to be able to reflect on that. I wish I would have known in the moment that this media had been developed by her, because it was really empowering for me to find out that, you know, when all of us get infections and we need to figure out if the antibiotic will work or not, when your doctor prescribes you an antibiotic, it's because Jane Hinton developed this media that will help us to understand whether or not the antibiotic will work. And so we need to uncover these stories so that we can propel women when they are in those moments and those times where the imposter voice is telling you you're not good enough, you're not adequate, that there's stories of women who've been there the whole time. Even if they've been hidden, they've been there the whole time paving the way for you.
You know, that is an incredible, powerful story, one that resonates really, really well and will resonate really well throughout this program. Let us just turn just for a moment to Ramona. And Ramona, I know one of the things I would like to know is, if you were talking to a student about majoring in engineering, do you have to go into nuclear weapons? I mean, are there any other options that would be available to you? What would you say to them?
You definitely don't have to go into nuclear weapons. In fact, I'd never imagined that I would be working in nuclear weapons. I have a large amount of African-American female engineering friends, and mostly because we all went to school together. But some of them have gone on to become lawyers. Some have become consultants. My very best friend, she is a professor teaching robotics now. And so there is really just a wide range of job opportunities that you can take on once you become an engineer. But you have that strong foundation in math and science, and you can use that really to do anything you want to do.
We are happy to hear you give that advice to girls who would be listening. And so, and I hope that they would take it. We have one more question we want to ask our panelists before we bring in two more hidden figures that you have not met yet. So we got to go back to Dr. Betty Harris just for a few moments. And Dr. Harris, I'm going back to you because we had a question to come in just directed to you. And it said, they would like to know what Mary McLeod Bethune said to your class when she addressed you. So would you share that with our listening audience? That is a piece of history that I think most people are really looking forward to hearing.
Yes. As I said, she came to us on one of the Freedom Days in which they were displaying the work of the Freedom Riders. And so when Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune came and addressed us and stood on this box and said, this beautiful little black woman, it made really a great impact on most of us, because we were junior high. I think I was eighth grade, and our biggest thing to do was to push each other off of the end of the seat and eat lunch. Well, this lady kind of turned us around to have us focus on more adult-like things that we could be about. And so even though this was just a one-day, one-event encounter, I was very thrilled to know that there was people in my life that I had met that could do all of these wonderful things. And when she said she started Bethune-Cookman College, I knew I had met somebody who was great.
Wow. So you have just summarized everything that I think that has been said today. Anyone can move a mountain, and anyone can acquire and achieve most anything if they just put their hearts and minds to it. Ladies, you have been an exceptional group of hidden figures that are no longer hidden. We'll be back with you in just a moment when we bring some more hidden figures to KUNM Radio and Women's Focus. Stay tuned. This is Pamela Herndon, and you're back with Women's Focus, where we are looking at hidden figures in New Mexico, those African-American women who excelled in science, technology, engineering, and math. So before we left for the break, we were receiving lots of texts and phone calls and questions. Although we won't be able to get to all of them on the air, one of the questions that was raised and it was through the conversation that was with Dr. Melanie Moses, and the listener wanted to know what was the name of the book that her mother gave her when she was younger. So the name of the book was called Godel Escher Bach. So that was the name of the book, and so she wants the listeners to know that was it and to please share it with your daughters. But right now we're going to turn to two other amazing hidden figures in the state of New Mexico. I'd like to welcome to the program Dr. Ndidi Amaka, and I'm going to say this, Aparifar. And I went over this and I know I messed it up. So I'll let you introduce yourself.
Sure. My name is Dr. Ndidi Amaka Opareke.
Thank you. I was pretty close.
Yes.
And then we also have with us Dr. Victoria Enriale. Did I pronounce that right?
That's close. It's Victoria Enriale.
All right. So I am very happy to have you both here on the program here in Women's Focus, where we're looking at these hidden figures in New Mexico. And you two ladies are definitely hidden figures that we want the rest of New Mexico to know about. Let's go to Dr. Ndidi first, and let's talk a little bit about her work and what she's doing here in New Mexico. So why don't you share some of that with us?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me first. It's a pleasure to be here. I thank God for today. I would like the whole of New Mexico to know that I have designed and constructed Rio Rancho's first and only compounding pharmacy. So I'm a pharmacist. I've been a pharmacist now for 9 years. I've been practicing pharmacy in the retail and the hospital settings. And now I've become an entrepreneur to open up the first compounding pharmacy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico.
Now, what is a compounding pharmacy?
Sure. A lot of people have that question. And a compounding pharmacy is where we as pharmacists, we take active pharmaceutical ingredients, and we make medications that people need. So you may need a specific dose or a specific dosage form that's not commercially available, and we can make exactly what you need for your body and your health.
And doing a little bit of research around the state of New Mexico, how many compounding pharmacies, do you think there are in our state?
Well, I can name a few. There may be more than this. I know we have Sharon Care in Belen. They do compounding. Manal Compounding over on the east side of Albuquerque. We also have Highland Compounding here in the university area. We also have a few compounding pharmacies in Santa Fe, but there is nothing on the west side, and there's nothing in Rio Rancho. So Olive Tree Compounding Pharmacy is the first.
Olive Tree Compounding Pharmacies. And so that's you are also the pharmacy that is run by an African-American woman.
Yes, ma'am. I am the first African-American woman in the state of New Mexico to design and build a compounding pharmacy.
Oh, we are so lucky that you're here.
Thank you.
Tell us how you chose New Mexico to pursue your career and to have your compounding pharmacy.
Well, I guess I consider myself a native now. I've lived in New Mexico since the age of 14. My parents moved here from California. I was born and raised in California. So I attended Sandia High School. From there, I went on to the University of New Mexico, where I studied biochemistry. And then I went to the College of Pharmacy at the University of New Mexico. So since 2008, I've been practicing pharmacy.
So how did you get interested in the sciences that would be involved in pharmacy? Tell us about that story.
Oh, well, I've always been inquisitive. I've always wondered, you know, how things work. How does life form? How does it take shape? Where does it start? Of course, I know that we have a creator, God, who creates everything. But from there, you know, I know there are chemical reactions and, you know, physical properties of different formulas and chemicals that come together to allow us to create. And so I just studied that in school. I studied biochemistry. I studied about the body, anatomy, and physiology to learn, you know, okay, well, when you take a chemical, what does it do in your body? What is your body made of? How does it react to certain things in the environment?
So are there any other pharmacists or scientists in your family, or are you the first?
Well, I do have a brother who is a doctor of physical therapy. I do have a younger sister who is at Tufts University in Boston. She's in medical school. My father actually was he was a scientist, but he worked for Lockheed Martin as a satellite engineer. And my mother is a nurse. So all of our fields, I guess they do have some aspect of science and math to them.
So this is quite an important topic to talk about, compounding pharmacy. I knew the story of a young girl who had psoriasis. And so the only way, and she had a really very, very aggressive form of psoriasis. And the best way that it could be taken care of was through some compounding of some medicines that included a tar base that she was able to use on her skin to actually help alleviate the difficulty, the itching, and the appearance of the psoriasis that she was having. So is that also the type of compounding that you're doing at your pharmacy?
Yes, ma'am. You know, pharmacy actually dates back to the apothecary. And in the apothecary, typically you would see a male pharmacist who would take your prescription and make whatever you need. And so now pharmacy has developed to include women and also to include African-American women. And so I, as your pharmacist, I would take a prescription from your doctor and I would be able to construct and design a specific dose in a specific dosage form specifically tailored to your needs. And so I see patients who are pediatric patients all the way up until the hospice patient. I can design medications for seizures, for ADHD, for autism. I can also design medications for hormone replacement therapy in both men and women. I can also make medications for animals, so for dogs, for cats. I do have one patient who is a dog. He needs gabapentin. This medication is typically used for seizures, and there are some other specifications that it can be used for. But basically, I take prescriptions from prescribers throughout the state of New Mexico, and I make specific doses and dosage forms for our patients. So I can make a cream, I can make a gel, I can make a lollipop, a suppository, a gummy bear. There's so many things that I can make. I can flavor medications. So for dogs, I can make doggy treats, or for cats, cat treats, and I can flavor them with tuna or with beef or bacon flavor. So there's so many things that I can do. So really, compounding pharmacy is the art of designing medication specifically for a patient.
Well, I'm impressed because I know that there are so many times people don't like taking just regular medication, and to think I can take medication through a gummy bear is pretty impressive.
Yes.
Let's move and let's just talk for a minute to Dr. Victoria. So, Dr. Victoria, you know, it is a great pleasure to have you here with us today, and we want the state of New Mexico and all of our listeners to know about you. So would you tell us about your work and what you're doing here in the state?
Thank you very much. So originally I'm from Nigeria, and I went to school in Nigeria, and I migrated to the U.S. in 1999. So what I've done so far, my story has been coming from very little background of school. I grew up in a culture where girls are not very not valued much, but things are changing, thank God. And I grew up in a school whereby we had very little. We had a science lab, which was more of a fiction than a reality. So to have come from that background now to become a scientist is very impressive. And the message that I like to tell young kids, and including my children, is you're blessed to be in America. You have a lot at your beck and call. If I can be a scientist, having very little background, very little science, you can do a lot more with where you are and what you have at your disposal. So right now I work in clinical trials with a pharmaceutical company. So there are various clinical trial studies going on in the U.S. and outside of the U.S. And what if you're asking what is clinical trials? So when you design the drug in the lab, it has to go through certain phases whereby the drug has to go through phase one trials, make sure it's safe, make sure it does what it's supposed to do, and it doesn't create unnecessary side effects that we can't handle before the drug gets approved by the FDA and gets marketed.
So let's talk a little bit more about your education and where you started did you call it your hometown or your village?
Hometown. It was in Lagos, Nigeria.
And so tell us about your educational steps as you then began to come here and ended up in New Mexico.
Great. So I went to this secondary school in a public school in Lagos. And I'll tell you, we had science teachers, but we didn't really do science. What we did back then was we read about science until I got to the UK as a teenager at the age of 17. And I did my A-levels, advanced level sciences in the UK, and I actually knew what science was. I began to see the apparatus that we only drew diagrams, you know, back then in Lagos. I actually saw them in real life. I'm like, science came alive. And I've always been an inquisitive child. You know, you tell me something works this way, I want to know why. How does it work? They gave us so many herbal medicines growing up. You have hemorrhoids and they give you this tea and that tastes nasty. And I'm wondering, why do I have to take this? I hated having malaria back in Nigeria because you will have to drink the tea. You will have to take a bath with the tea. And it tasted nasty because it was all full of quinine. And so when I grew up, I got to London and I got into a real laboratory. I wanted to know how things worked, how science really, really worked. And that's how I pursued my career in science.
So if I go back to your school in Lagos just for a moment, so the science books that you had did not come along with a science lab. And the science books, did they provide you with what type of science background? Can you talk a little bit about that? This is very interesting.
Sure. We had, if you had a textbook in my days, I mean, some people went to private schools that provided books, but I went to a public school. As a matter of fact, growing up, I had no idea I was poor until years back. I'm like, what was that? but luckily, it never hindered me, you know, thank God. And we had textbook. If you have a textbook, one, maybe 10 of you have to share a textbook, or you have to make photocopies and just share with your friends. We had a science teacher, but we had nothing to experiment with. We just learned about the processes, the periodic table. We did the theory pretty much from the textbooks.
And so when you went to school in London and science came alive, then what was your next step after that? So tell us how you then progressed in your career.
Oh, it was very exciting. I was really excited. I'm like, oh, wow, this is Boyle's apparatus. This is a Bernstein burner. You can make things. I also learned about food science technology and food technology during my A-levels. And I went ahead, I did a pharmacology degree. And after my pharmacology degree, and pharmacology pretty much is learning what the drug does to the body, how the drug works in the body. I did that as a first degree. I liked my final year project, which was working in drug delivery systems, and I wanted to learn more. I'm like, I want to do more. I want to improve how medications are being targeted to a particular site, how, for example, you have cancer cells and you can deliver a drug specifically to the cancer cell without hurting the normal cell. So I went ahead and did a PhD in drug delivery systems in University of London, where I learned much more. I was able to explore. I'm like, okay, I want to know more. How can we work? I worked with calcitonin, which is a protein. It's used in treating osteoporosis. And the way calcitonin is administered is it's by injection. But I'm asking the question, how else can we give this medication? Not everybody likes injection. Can we probably put it in oral form, in tablets and stuff? So I did my research into that. And I have to tell you, my research did not work to develop a marketed product for calcitonin, but I did learn a lot from that experience from my supervisor, who says, you know, sometimes in life, you learn much more from failure than you learn from success. Mm-hmm.
And so now you're over here in the United States and you're doing work for a pharmaceutical company. And so have you always been with the same pharmaceutical company, or did you move to engage in your work with others?
Yes, I also worked with a pharmaceutical company in the UK, and then I transferred to the US with the same pharmaceutical company, which was SmithKline-Beecham, now GlaxoSmithKline. So, but I'm with a different pharmaceutical company now. So I worked with different pharmaceutical companies, big pharmas here in the U.S., internationally also. I've had a chance to go to India, Bangalore, India, and train more people that we work with. We have affiliates in this business all over the world, in the U.K., and it's a privilege knowing that with the meager background, you get to go to those places, you get to tell people about science programs, the STEM programs, encourage kids to, you know, you can ask questions and you can ask, get answers from it. And you can go far.
So tell us a little bit how you engage with other girls or other students about getting involved in science or some of the STEM programs.
Okay. So for me, STEM program starts in my home with my children. So we're, you know, it's as easy as we're doing things. We're cooking, we're washing fish, and I'm giving them gloves to put on. And they want to see the brain of the fish. I'm like, great, we're going to do dissection right here in my kitchen. And that's how we started. You know, my kids are very inquisitive. They're very smart. They're great kids. And then one by one, they will invite me, Mommy, I want you to do science in my school, in my classroom. So I've done it from kindergarten I've done middle school science. I've done high school science with all of my children pretty much saying, Mommy, we want you to be the science teacher. And I'm like, no, I think I'll just be the guest science scientist, and let's keep it that way. So, and also, I'm also on the board for Tuskegee MN International, the TAI group here in New Mexico. I'm the secretary, and we also have STEM programs where during the summertime there's the aviation camp, the space camp, and we do collaborate with other establishments, organizations here in New Mexico, teaching and encouraging science careers that you can do it. It's possible.
So is there an opportunity for students to intern with you in the summertime, to work with you, to learn about how to dissect the brain or the fish before they eat it?
Yeah, just go to her house.
Yeah, really, it's everywhere. Right now, I don't work in a lab because I'm working in clinical trials pretty much. But yeah, if I come to the table, we have the right apparatus, I have my tools, my kits, and we'll just order the organs and whatever we need. And I'll show you and make fun out of it that science. My kids went to a school where they were reading about science in Gallup, and I said, no, this is not acceptable. We need to do science hands-on.
So let me go to Dr. Ndidi for just a moment. So is there a way that girls can come and learn about compounding pharmacy processes with you? Do you have any opportunities for internships and for learning?
Yes, definitely. In fact, today was the first day of my first pharmacy intern. He started today. He's a fourth year at the University of New Mexico College of Pharmacy. He'll be graduating in May. But what I do plan to do for the community is have outreach programs for children from the ages of kindergarten all the way up until high school. I know there's a gentleman over at Rio Rancho High School who reached out to me to work with the DECA program. But basically, I want to work with children who are either excited about the business aspect of pharmacy or even the pharmacy, the compounding aspect of pharmacy. And what I plan to do is design a compounding lab, a type of curriculum where they can actually come into the lab and design compounds that they're interested in. So I may have a student who's interested in making a suppository, or someone who's interested in making a lollipop or a cream or a gel. We can do all of that. And so that is soon to come this summer, 2017.
Wow. I can just see it now. Girls around the state are going to be flocking to the two of you all. But let me just ask you this one question that we did ask our other panelists. What kind of barriers did you face in putting together your career and moving it forward? Can you share a little bit about any type of barriers that you face as an African-American woman in your career? And how did you overcome those?
Well, I think the first barrier that I had to overcome was the fear in my mind and the fear in my spirit that this was impossible. I had to know that I serve a God who makes all things possible. And so once I really understood that and it ministered to me day in and day out, then I just took a leap of faith. I really did invest everything that I have in this pharmacy. I have three children. And when I look at my boys, I have to say, you know, Mommy is going to pave the way, you know, so that when you grow older, you will have a legacy. You will have something that, you know, that's tangible in your hands, and you can take that and run with it. And then you also have to step out into the community and make yourself known. That was scary because no one really looks like me. You know, you have to go to the bank, you have to go to the contractor, the architect, and they look at you like, wow, you're different. You're not like anyone that we've seen, you know. And then when you sit down with an architect and you pour out your mind and you say, this is the design I have, this is what I want it to look like, and they have this sense of amazement, you know, in their eyes. They just look at you like, wow, you're actually very intellectual, you know, and you're inspiring, you know. And then you go to the contractor, and from there you go to the bank, and you actually get approval for funding. You know, you go to the city of Rio Rancho, you sit with the mayor, you go to NAOP meetings, you go to NABO meetings, you know, all these organizations throughout the state of New Mexico. Excuse me, you make yourself known. And I think after all of the processes that I've been through, I feel like, you know, now there's nothing that I can't do. It's just put your mind to it. Be very prayerful and faithful. Be dedicated to the cause, you know, really pour into it. And definitely you'll reap what you sow.
Wow. Those are very, very powerful words. And so you're going to have the closing words, Dr. Victoria, to tell us what advice would you give to young girls who are in high school right now, determining what to do with their careers and how to set their careers. What advice would you give them today?
So the advice I will give is no matter where you are, even if you don't have a lot right now, even if a lot of people are saying, no, you can't do that, I say, look inside yourself and find the power. I was the first in many ways in my family, in my career, in my academics, in being in the U.S. I was the first in many ways, and I realized that there are other people watching me. I'm doing this not just for myself. I'm sowing seeds for myself and for others around me. And so if school doesn't make sense to you right now, if you're wondering, why do I have to do calculus? Why do I have to wake up every morning and drag myself to school? Just keep going. I say persevere, because you're sowing seeds, and one day you will reap the harvest. It will count. You will have options. You will have a better life, and you'll be able to make a difference in your world, in your community, in your country, and you'll be proud of yourself. So keep going. Don't stop.
Well, I want you to know, ladies, that I've received numerous texts on my phone saying thank you for sharing your stories with New Mexico Today.